risen up, searching, I guessed, for a retina-wired peripheral scroll-down. The virtuality had been written not to render internal hardware, except in Mandrake personnel, but she showed no surprise at a lack of response, so maybe she was just remembering it the old-fashioned way. It was a squadron of automated armor. Spider tanks. I was trying to undermine their response parameters, but there was a viral booby trap wired into the control systems. A Rawling variant, I believe.
The mild grimace again.
There was very little time to take stock, as you can probably imagine, so I can't be sure. In any event, there was no time to jack out. The primary baffles of the virus had already welded me in. In the time I had before it downloaded fully, I could only come up with the one option.
Very impressive, said Hand. When it was done, we went back up to the roof to clear our heads. I leaned on a parapet and looked out over the curfewed quiet of landfall, while Hand went off to find some coffee. The terraces behind me were deserted, chairs and tables scattered like some hieroglyphic message left for orbital eyes. The night had cooled off while we were below, and the breeze made me shiver. Suddenly Ping's words came back to me. Rawling variant. It was the Rawling virus that had killed the Inanen beachhead, had made Jimmy DeSoto claw out his own eye before he died. State-of-the-art back then, cheap off-the-rack military surplus now. The only viral software Kemp's hard-pressed forces could afford. Times change, but market forces are forever. History unreels. The real dead stay that way. The rest of us get to go on. Hand came back apologetically with machine coffee canisters. He handed me mine and leaned on the parapet at my side. So, what do you think? He asked after a while.
I think it tastes like shit.
He chuckled. What do you think about team?
They'll do.
I sipped at the coffee and brooded on the city below. I'm not over happy about the ninja, but he's got some useful skills and he seems prepared to get killed in the line of duty, which is always a big advantage in a soldier. How long to prep the clones?
2 days. Maybe a little less.
It'll be twice that before these people are up to speed on a new sleeve. Can we do the induction in virtual?
I see no reason why not. The MAI can spin out 100% accurate renderings for each clone from the raw data in the biolab machines. Running at 350 times real, we can give the whole team a full month on their new sleeves on site in the Dangrik construct, all inside a couple of hours real time.
Good, I said, and wondered why it didn't feel that way.
My own reservations are with Suchiade. I'm not convinced that a man like that can be expected to take orders well.
I shrugged. So give him the command.
Are you serious?
Why not? He's qualified for it, he's got the rank, and he's had the experience. Seems to have loyalty to his men.
Han said nothing. I could sense his frown across the half-meter of parapet that separated us.
What?
Nothing.
He cleared his throat.
I had just assumed you would want the command yourself.
I saw the platoon again, as the smart shrapnel barrage erupted overhead. Lightning flash, explosions, and then the fragments, skipping and hissing hungrily through the quicksilver flashing curtain of the rain. Crackling of blaster discharge in the background, like something ripping.
Screams.
What was on my face didn't feel like a smile, but evidently it was.
What's so funny?
You've read my file, Hand.
Yes.
And you still thought I wanted the command. Are you fucking insane?
Chapter 15. The coffee kept me awake.
Hand went to bed, or whatever canister he crawled into when Mandrake wasn't using him, and left me staring at the desert night. I searched the sky for Sol and found it glimmering in the east at the apex of a constellation the locals called the Thumb Home. Han's words drifted back through me. So far from Earth you have to work hard to pick out Sol in the night sky. We were carried here on a wind that blows in a dimension we cannot see or touch. stored as dreams in the mind of a machine. I shook it off, irritably. It wasn't like I'd been born there. Earth was no more home to me than Sanction 4, and if my father had ever pointed Saul out to me in between bouts of drunken violence, I had no memory of it. Any significance that particular point of light had for me, I'd gotten off a disk. And from here you couldn't even see the star that Harlan's world orbited. Maybe that's the problem. Or maybe it was just that I'd been there, to the legendary home of the human race. And now looking up, I could imagine a single astronomical unit out from the glimmering star. A world in spin. A city by the sea dropping away into darkness as night came on. Or rolling back up and into the light. A police cruiser parked somewhere, and a certain police lieutenant drinking coffee not much better than mine, and maybe thinking, "That's enough, Kovach. For your information, the light you're watching arrive left 50 years before she was even born. And that sleeve you're fantasizing about is in its 60s by now, if she's even wearing it still. Let it go." Yeah. I knocked back the dregs of the coffee, grimaced as it went down cold. By the look of the eastern horizon, dawn was on its way, and I had a sudden, crushing desire not to be here when it arrived. I left the coffee carton standing sentinel on the parapet, and picked my way back through the scattered chairs and tables to the nearest elevator terminal. The elevator dropped me the 3 floors to my suite, and I made it along the gently curving corridor without meeting anyone. I was pulling the retina cup out the door on its saliva-thin cable when the sound of footfalls in the machined quiet sent me back against the opposite wall, right hand reaching for the single interface gun I still carried, from habit, tucked into the back of my waistband. Spooked. "You're in the Mandrake Tower, Kovach. Executive levels. Not even dust gets up here without authorization. Get a fucking grip, will you?"
"Kovach?"
Tanya Wardani's voice. I swallowed and pushed myself away from the wall. Wardani rounded the curve of the corridor and stood looking at me with what seemed like an unusual proportion of uncertainty in her stance.
"I'm sorry. Did I scare you?"
"No." Reaching again for the retina cup, which had back-reeled into the door when I went for the Kalashnikov.
"Have you been up all night?"
"Yes." I applied the cup to my eye, and the door folded back. "You?"
"More or less. I tried to get some sleep a couple of hours ago, but..."
She shrugged.
"Too keyed up. Are you all done?"
"With the recruiting?"
"Yes."
"Yes."
"How are they?"
"Good enough." The door made an apologetic chiming sound, drawing attention to the lack of entry effected so far.
"Are you..."
"Do you?" I gestured.
"Thanks."
She moved awkwardly and stepped in ahead of me. The suite lounge was walled in glass that I'd left at semi-opaque when I went out. City lights specked the smoky surface like deep fry caught glowing in a Millsport trawler's nets. Wardani halted in the middle of the subtly finished living space and turned about.
"I..."
"Have a seat. The mob ones are all chairs."
"Thanks. I still can't quite get used to..."
"State of the art." I watched as she perched on the edge of one of the modules, and it tried in vain to lift and shape itself around her body. "Want a drink?"
"No, thanks."
"Pipe?"
"God, no."
"So how's the hardware?"
"It's good."
She nodded, more to herself than anyone.
"Yes. Good enough."
"Good."
"You think we're nearly ready?"
I pushed away the flash rip behind my eyes and crossed to one of the other seats, making a performance of settling into it. "We're waiting for developments up there. You know that."
"Yes."
A shared quiet.
"Do you think they'll do it?"
"Who? The cartel?" I shook my head. "Not if they can help it. But Kemp might. Look, Tanya, it may not even happen. But whether it does or not, there's nothing any of us can do about it. It's too late for that kind of intervention now. Way war works.
abolition of the individual.
What's that, some kind of Quellist epigram?
I smiled. Loosely paraphrased, yes. You want to know what Quell had to say about war? About all violent conflict? She made a restless motion.
Not really. Okay, sure, tell me. Why not? Tell me something I haven't heard before.
She said wars are fought over hormones. Male hormones, largely. It's not about winning or losing at all. It's about hormonal discharge. She wrote a poem about it, back before she went underground. Let's see. I closed my eyes and thought back to Harlan's world. A safe house in the hills above Millsport. Stolen Bioware stacked in a corner. Pipes and post-op celebration wreathing the air. Idly arguing politics with Virginia Vidara and her crew, the famous Little Blue Bugs. Quellist quotes and poetry bantered back and forth.
You in pain?
I opened my eyes and shot her a reproachful glance. Tanya, this stuff was mostly written in Stripjap. That's a Harlan's World trade tongue, gibberish to you. I'm trying to remember the Imanglic version.
Well, it looks painful. Don't knock yourself out on my account.
I held up a hand. Goes like this. Male-sleeved. Stop up your hormones. Or spend them in moans. Of other caliber. We'll reassure you. The load is large enough. Blood pumped. Pride in your prowess. We'll fail you. Fuck you. And everything you touch. You'll reassure us. The price was small enough. I sat back. She sniffed.
Bit of an odd stance for a revolutionary. Didn't she lead some kind of bloody uprising? Fight to the death against protectorate tyranny or something?
Yeah. Several kinds of bloody uprising, in fact. But there's no evidence she actually died. She disappeared in the last battle for Millsport. They never recovered a stack.
I don't really see how storming the gates of this Millsport gels with that poem.
I shrugged. Well, she never really changed her views on the roots of violence, even in the thick of it. Just realized it couldn't be avoided, I guess. Changed her actions instead, to suit the terrain.
That's not much of a philosophy.
No, it isn't. But Quellism was never very big on dogma. About the only credo Quell ever subscribed to was face the facts. She wanted that on her tomb. Face the facts. That meant dealing with them creatively, not ignoring them or trying to pretend they're just some historical inconvenience. She always said you can't control a war, even when she was starting one.
Sounds a little defeatist to me.
Not at all. It's just recognition of the danger. Facing the facts. Don't start wars if you can possibly avoid it, because once you do, it's out of any sane control. No one can do anything except try to survive while it runs its hormonal course. Hold on to the rod and ride it out. Stay alive and wait for the discharge.
Whatever.
She yawned and looked out of the window.
I'm not very good at waiting, Kovach. You'd think being an archaeologue would have cured me of that, wouldn't you?
A shaky little laugh.
That and the camp.
I stood up abruptly. Let me get you that pipe.
No.
She hadn't moved, but her voice was nailed down solid.
I don't need to forget anything, Kovach. I need...
She cleared her throat.
I need you to do something for me. With me. What you did to me. Before, I mean. What you did as...
She looked down at her hands.
Had an impact I didn't expect.
Ah, I sat down again. That.
Yes, that.
There was a flicker of anger in her tone now.
I suppose it makes sense. It's an emotion-bending process.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. Well, there's one particular emotion I need bending back into place now, and I don't really see any other way to do that than by fucking you.
I'm not sure that...
I don't care!
She said violently.
You changed me. You fixed me.
Her voice quieted.
I suppose I should be grateful. But that isn't how it feels. I don't feel grateful. I feel fixed. You've created this imbalance in me, and I want that part of me back.
Look, Tanya, you aren't really in any condition.
Oh, that.
She smiled thinly.
I appreciate I'm not exactly sexually attractive right now, except maybe...
Wasn't what I meant.
To a few freaks who like starved pubescence to fuck. No, we'll need to fix that. We need to go virtual for this.
I struggled to shake off a numbing sense of unreality. You want to do this now?
Yes, I do.
Another sliced-off smile.
It's interfering with my sleep patterns, Kovac, and right now I need my sleep.
Do you have somewhere in mind?
Yes.
It was like a children's game of dare. So where is that exactly?
Downstairs.
She got up and looked down at me.
You know, you ask a lot of questions for a man who's about to get laid.
Downstairs was a floor about midway up the tower that the elevator announced as a recreational level. The doors opened onto the unpartitioned space of a fitness center, machines bulking insect-like and menacing in the unlit gloom. Toward the back, I spotted the tilted webs of a dozen or so virtual link racks. "We doing this out here?" I asked uncomfortably.
"No. Closed chambers at the back. Come on."
We passed through the forest of stilled machines, lights flickering up above and among them, then flickering out again as we moved on. I watched the process out of a neurasthetic grotto that had been growing up around me like coral since before I came down from the roof. Too much virtuality will do that to you sometimes. There's this vague feeling of abrasion in the head when you disconnect. A disquieting sense that reality isn't quite sharp enough anymore. A waxing and waning fuzziness that might be what the edge of madness feels like. The cure for this definitely is not more virtual time. There were 9 closed chambers, modular blisters swelling out of the end wall under their respective numbers. 7 and 8 were cracked open, spilling low orange light around the line of the hatch. Wardani stopped in front of 7, and the door hinged outward. The orange light expanded pleasantly in the gap, turned into soft hypno-mode. No dazzle. She turned to look back at me.
"Go ahead,"
she said.
8 is slave to this one. Just hit consensual on the menu pad."
And she disappeared into the warm orange glow. Inside Module 8, someone had seen fit to cover the walls and roofing with empathist psychogram art, which in the hypno-mode lighting seemed little more than a random set of fishtail swirls and spots. Then again, that's what most empathist stuff looks like to me in any light. The air was just the right side of warm, and beside the auto-mold couch there was a complicated spiral of metal to hang clothes. I stripped off and settled on the auto-mold, pulled down the headgear, and swiped the flashing consensual diamond as the displays came online. I'd just remembered to knock out the physical feedback baffle option before the system kicked in. The orange light appeared to thicken, taking on a foggy substance through which the psychogram swirls and dots swam like complex equations, or maybe some kind of pond life. I had a moment to wonder if the artist had intended either of those comparisons. Empathists are a weird lot. And then the orange was fading and shredding away like steam, and I stood in an immense tunnel of black vented metal panels, lit only by lines of flashing red diodes that receded to infinity in both directions. In front of me, more of the orange fog boiled up out of a vent and shredded into a recognizably female form. I watched, fascinated, as Tanya Wardani began to emerge from the general outline, made at first entirely of flickering orange smoke, then seemingly veiled in it from head to foot, then clad only in patches, and then, as these tore away, clad in nothing at all. Glancing down at myself, I saw I was similarly naked.
"Welcome to the loading deck."
Looking up again, my first thought was that she had already gone to work on herself. Most constructs load on self-images held in the memory. With subroutines to beat anything too delusional, you end up looking pretty much the way you do in reality, less a couple of kilos, and maybe plus a centimeter or two. The version of Tanya Wardani I was looking at didn't have those kinds of discrepancies. It was more a general sheen of health that she didn't yet have back in the real world, or perhaps just the lack of a similar, more grimy sheen of unhealth. The eyes were less sunken, the cheek and collarbones less pronounced. Under the slightly pouched breasts, the ribs were there, but fleshed far past what I'd imagined below her draped clothing.
"They're not big on mirrors in the camp,"
she said, maybe reading something in my expression.
"Except for interrogation. And after a while, you try not to see yourself in windows walking past. I probably still look a lot worse than I think I do, especially after that instant fix you loaded into me."
I couldn't think of anything even remotely appropriate to say.
"You, on the other hand..."
She stepped forward, and reaching out low, caught me by the prick.
"Well, let's see what you've got here."
I was hard almost instantly. Maybe it was something written into the protocols of the system. Maybe just too long without the release. Or maybe there was some unclean fascination in anticipating the use of this body with its slightly accented marks of privation. Enough to hint artfully at abuse, not enough to repel. Freaks who like starved pubescents to fuck? No telling how a combat sleeve might be wired at this level, or any male sleeve come to that. Dig down into the blood depths of hormonal bedrock, where violence and sex and power grow fibrously entwined. It's a murky, complicated place down there. No telling what you'll drag up once you start excavating.
"That's good,"
she breathed, abruptly close to my ear. She had not let go.
"But I don't rate this much. You haven't been looking after yourself, soldier."
Her other hand spread wide and scraped up my belly from the roots of my prick to the arc of my ribcage. Like a carpenter's sanding glove, planing back the layering of flab that had begun to thicken over my sleeve's tank-grown abdominal musculature. I glanced down and saw with a slight visceral shock that some of the flab really had started to plane off, fading out with the motion of her flattened palm. It left a warm feeling threaded through the muscle beneath, like whiskey going down.
"System magic,"
I managed through the spasm, as she tugged hard at me with a gripping hand and repeated the upward smoothing gesture with the other. I lifted my own hands toward her, and she skipped back.
"Uh-uh."
She took another step away.
"I'm not ready yet. Look at me."
She lifted both hands and cupped her breasts, pushed upward with the heels of her palms, and then let them fall back, fuller, larger. The nipples, had one of them been broken before? Swollen dark and conical like chocolate sheathing on the copper skin.
"Like that?"
she asked.
"Very much."
She repeated the open-handed grasping motion, topping it with a circular massaging action. When she let go this time, her breasts were well on their way to the dimensions of one of Dejoko Ruespenoeji's gravity-defying concubines. She reached back and did something similar to her buttocks, turning to show me the cartoon rounding she'd given them. She bent forward and pulled the cheeks apart.
"Lick me,"
she said with sudden urgency. I went down on one knee and pressed my face into the crease, spearing forward with my tongue, working at the tight whorl of closed sphincter. I wrapped an arm around one long thigh to steady myself, and with the other hand I reached up and found her already wet. The ball of my thumb sank into her from the front as my tongue worked deeper from the rear, both rubbing soft, synchronized circles amid her insides. She grunted, somewhere at the base of the throat, and we shifted into liquid blue. The floor was gone, and most of the gravity with it. I thrashed and lost my thumb hold. Wardani twisted languidly around and fastened to me like bellaweed around a rock. The fluid was not water. It had left our skin slick against each other, and I could breathe it as well as if it were tropical air, I gasped my lungs full of it as Wardani slithered down, biting at my chest and stomach, and finally laid hands and mouth on my hard-on. I didn't last long. Floating in the infinite blue, while Tanya Wardani's newly pneumatic breasts pressed against my thighs, and her nipples traced up and down on my oiled skin, and her mouth sucked and her curled fingers pumped, I had just enough time to notice a light source above us before my neck muscles started to tauten, cranking my head back, and the twitching messages along my nerves gathered together for a final climactic rush. There was a scratch replay vibrato effect built into the construct. My orgasm went on for over 30 seconds. As it tailed off, Tanya Wardani floated up past me, hair spread around her face, threads of semen blown out amid bubbles from the corners of her grin. I struck out and grabbed one passing thigh, dragged her back into range. She flexed in the water analog as my tongue sank into her, and more bubbles ran out of her mouth. I caught the reverberation of her moan through the fluid like the sympathetic vibration of jet engines in the pit of my stomach, and felt myself stiffening in response. I pressed my tongue down harder, forgetting to breathe, and then discovering I didn't actually need to for a long time. Wardani's writhing grew more urgent, and she crooked her legs around my back to anchor herself in place. I cupped her buttocks and squeezed, pushing my face into the folds of her cunt, then slid my thumb back inside her and recommenced the soft, circular motion in counterpoint to the spiraling of my tongue. She gripped my head in both hands and crushed my face against her. Her writhings became thrashings, her moans a sustained shout that filled my ears like the sound of surf overhead. I sucked. She stiffened and screamed, and then shuddered for minutes. We drifted to the surface together. An astronomically unlikely red giant sun was sinking at the horizon, bathing the suddenly normalized water around us in stained glass light. Two moons sat high in the eastern sky, and behind us waves broke on a white sand beach fringed by palms.
"Did you write this?"
I asked, treading water and nodding at the view.
"Hardly."
She wiped water out of her eyes and slicked back her hair with both hands.
"It's off the rack. I checked out what they had this afternoon. Why? You like it?"
"So far. But I have a feeling that sun is an astronomical impossibility."
"Yeah, well, breathing underwater's not overly realistic either."
"I didn't get to breathe." I held my hands above the water in claws, miming the grip she'd had on my head, and pulled a suffocated face. "This bring back any memories?" To my amazement, she flushed scarlet. Then she laughed, splashed water in my face, and struck out for the shore. I treaded water for a moment, laughing too, and then went after her. The sand was warm, powder fine, and systematically unwilling to stick to wet flesh. Behind the beach, coconuts fell sporadically from the palms and, unless collected, broke down into fragments that were carried away by tiny, jewel-colored crabs. We fucked again at the water's edge. Tanya Wardani seated astride my cock, cartoon ass bedded soft and warm on my crossed legs. I buried my face in her breasts, settled hands at her hips, and lifted her gently up and down until the shuddering started in her again. Caught me like a contagious fever, and ran through us both. The scratch replay subroutine had a resonance system built in that cycled the orgasm back and forth between us like an oscillating signal, swamping and ebbing for what felt like forever. It was love. Perfect passion compatibility, trapped, distilled, and amped up almost beyond bearing.
"You knock out the baffles?"
she asked me, a little breathlessly, after.
"Of course. You think I want to go through all this and still come out swilling full of semen and sex hormones?" go through?
She lifted her head from the sand, outraged. I grinned back. Sure. This is for your benefit, Tanya. I wouldn't be here other... Hey, no throwing sand!
Fucking...
Look. I fended off the fistful of sand with one arm and pushed her into the surf. She went over backward, laughing. I stood up in a ludicrous Miki Nozawa fighting stance, while she picked herself up. Something out of Siren Fist Demons. Don't try to lay your profane hands on me, woman.
Looks to me like you want to have hands laid on you,
she said, shaking back her hair and pointing. It was true. The sight of the system magic enhanced body, beaded with water, had the signals flickering through my nerve endings again, and my glands was already filling up with blood like a ripening plum in time-lapse fast-forward sequence. I gave up the guard and glanced around the construct. You know, off the rack or not, this is some good shit, Tanya.
Last year's cybersex down seal of approval, apparently.
She shrugged.
I took a chance. You want to try the water again? Or apparently there's this waterfall thing back through the trees.
Sounds good to me. On the way past the front line of palms, with their huge phallic trunks lifting like dinosaur necks off the sand, I scooped up a newly fallen coconut. The crabs scattered with comic speed, scuttling for burrows in the sand from which they poked cautious eye stalks. I turned the coconut over in my hands. It had landed with a small chunk already torn out of the green shell, exposing soft, rubbery flesh beneath. Nice touch. I punctured the inner membrane with my thumb and tipped it back like a gourd. The milk inside was improbably chilled. Another nice touch. The forest floor beyond was conveniently clear of sharp debris and insects. Water poured and splashed somewhere with attention-grabbing clarity. An obvious path led through the palm trunks toward the sound. We walked, hand in hand, beneath rainforest foliage filled with brightly colored birds and small monkeys making suspiciously harmonic noises. The waterfall was a two-tier affair, pouring down in a long plume into a wide basin, then tumbling through rocks and rapids to another smaller pool, where the drop was less. I arrived slightly ahead of her, and stood on wet rocks at the edge of the second pool, arms akimbo, looking down. I repressed a grin. The moment was cleared for her to push me in, trembling with the potential. Nothing. I turned to look at her, and saw she was trembling slightly. Hoi, Tanya. I took her face between my hands. Are you okay? What's the matter? But I knew what the motherfucking matter was. Because envoy techniques or not, healing is a complex creeping process, and it'll glitch on you as soon as your back's turned. The motherfucking camp. The low-key arousal fled, leaching out of my system like saliva from a mouthful of lemon. The fury sheeted up through me. The motherfucking war. If I'd had Isaac Carrera and Joshua Kemp there, in the middle of all that Edenic beauty, I'd have torn their entrails out with my bare hands, knotted them together, and kicked them into the pool to drown. Can't drown in this water, sneered the part of me that would never shut down, the smug envoy control. You can breathe in this water. Maybe men like Kemp and Carrera couldn't. Yeah, right. So instead, I caught Tanya Wardani around the waist and crushed her against me, and jumped for us both. Chapter 16. I came out of it with an alkaline smell in my nostrils, and my belly sticky with fresh semen. My balls ached as if they'd been kicked. Over my head, the display had cleared to standby. A time check pulsed in one corner. I'd been under less than 2 minutes real time. I sat up, groggily. Fuck me. I cleared my throat and looked around. Fresh, self-moistening toweling hung from a roll behind the automold, presumably with just this in mind. I tore off a handful and wiped myself down, still trying to blink the virtuality out of my eyes. We'd fucked in the waterfall pool, languid underwater once Wardani's trembling had passed. We'd fucked again on the beach. We'd fucked back up in the loading deck, a last chance grabbed at leaving sort of thing. I tore off more towel, wiped my face, and rubbed at my eyes. I dressed slowly, stowed the smart gun, wincing as it prodded down from my waistband into my tender groin. I found a mirror on the wall of the chamber and peered into it, trying to sort out what had happened to me in there. Envoy's psycho glue. I'd used it on Wardani without really thinking about it, and now she was up and walking around. That was what I'd wanted. The dependency whiplash was an almost inevitable side effect, but so what? It was the kind of thing that didn't much matter in the usual Envoy run of things. As likely as not, you were in combat with other things to worry about. Often you'd moved on by the time it became a problem the subject had to deal with. What didn't generally happen was the kind of restorative purging Wardani had prescribed for herself and then gone after. I couldn't predict how that would work. I'd never known it to happen before, never even seen it before. I couldn't work out what she'd make me feel in turn. And I wasn't learning anything new looking at myself in the mirror. I built a shrug and a grin, and walked out of the chamber into the pre-dawn gloom among the stilled machines. Wardani was waiting outside by one of the open rig webs, and not alone. The thought jarred through my soggy nervous system, painfully sluggish, and then the unmistakable spike-and-ring configuration at the projection end of a sunjet was pushed against the back of my neck.
"You want to avoid any sudden moves, chum."
It was a strange accent, an equatorial twang to it even through the voice print distorter.
"Or you and your girlfriend here are going to be wearing no heads."
A professional hand snaked around my waist, plucked the Kalashnikov from its resting place, and tossed it away across the room. I heard the muffled clunk as it hit the carpeted floor and slid. Try to pinpoint it. Equatorial accent. Kempists. I looked over at Wardani, her oddly limp hanging arms, and the figure who held a smaller hand blaster to her nape. He was dressed in the form-fitting black of a stealth assault suit, and masked with clear plastic that moved in random waves over his face, distorting the features continually, except for two little watchful blue-tinted windows over the eyes. There was a pack on his back that had to carry whatever intrusion hardware they'd used to get in here. Had to be a bioscience imaging set, counterfeed code sampler, and Securus's sandbagger in their minimum. High fucking tech.
"You guys are so dead," I said, trying for amused calm.
"Extra funny, chum."
The one who'd taken me tugged at my arm and pulled me around, so I was looking down the ramping chute of the sunjet. Same dress code, same running plastic mask, same black pack. Two more clone-identical forms bulked behind him, watching opposite ends of the room. Their sunjets were cradled low, deceptively casual. My enthusiasm for the odds collapsed like a set of unplugged LED displays.
"Play for time."
"Who sent you guys?"
"Say,"
said the spokesman, voice squelching in and out of focus.
"It's rigged this way. Her we want. You're just carbon walking. Limit that mouth, maybe we lift you, too, just for tidiness. Keep gritting me. I'll make a mess just to see your Envoy gray cells fly. Am I coming through?"
I nodded, desperately trying to mop up the postcoital languor that had drenched my system, shifting my stance slightly, aligning from memory.
"Good. Then let's have your arms."
He dropped his left hand to his belt and produced a contact stunner. The aim of the sunjet never wavered in the right-hand grip. The mask flexed in an approximation of a smile.
"One at a time, of course."
I raised my left arm and held it out to him, flexed my right hand behind me, riding out the sense of impotent fury so the palm rippled. The little gray device came down on my wrist, charged light winking. He had to shift the sunjet, of course, or the dead weight of my arm was going to come down on it like a club when the stunner fired. Now, so low even the Nurikem barely picked it out.
a thin whine through the conditioned air. The stunner fired. Painless. Cold. A localized version of what it felt like to get shot with a beam stunner. The arm flopped like a dead fish, narrowly missing the sunjet despite its new alignment. He twitched slightly aside, but it was a relaxed move. The mask grinned.
That's good. Now the other one.
I smiled and shot him. Grav Microtech, a weapons engineering breakthrough from the House of Kalashnikov. From the hip, 3 times across the chest, hoping to drill clean through whatever armor he was wearing and into the backpack. Blood. Across short distances, the Kalashnikov AKS-91 interface gun will lift and fly direct to an implanted bio-alloy home plate. Drenched the stealth suit, tickled my face with back-blown spray. He staggered, sunjet wagging like an admonishing finger. His colleagues... Almost silent, the generator delivers total capacity in a 10-second burst. Hadn't worked it out yet. I fired high at the two behind him. Probably hit one of them somewhere. They rolled away, grabbing cover. Return fire crackled around me, nowhere close. I came around, dragging the numbed arm like a shoulder bag, looking for Wardani and her captor.
"Fucking don't, man, I'll—"
and shot through the writhing plastic of the mask. The slug punched him back a clean 3 meters, into the spidery arms of a climbing machine, where he hung, slumped and used up. Wardani dropped to the ground bonelessly. I threw myself down, chased by fresh sunjet fire. We landed nose to nose.
"You okay?"
I hissed. She nodded, cheek pressed flat to the floor, shoulders twitching as she tried to move her stunned arms.
"Good. Stay there."
I flailed my own numbed limb around and searched the machine jungle for the 2 remaining Kempists. No sign. Could be fucking anywhere, waiting for a clear shot.
Fuck this.
I lined up on the crumpled form of the squad leader on the backpack. 2 shots blew it apart, fragments of hardware jumping out of the exit holes in the fabric. Mandrake security woke up. Lights seared, sirens shrieked from the roof, and an insectile storm of nanocopters issued from vents in the walls. They swooped over us, blinked glass bead eyes, and passed us by. A few meters over, a flight of them rained laser fire down amid the machines. Screams. An abortive sunjet blast carving wildly through the air. The nanocopters it touched flamed and spun out like burning moths. The laser fire from the others redoubled, chickling. Screams powering down to sobbing. The sickly stench of charred flesh made it across in ribbons to where I lay. It was like a homecoming. The nanocopter swarm broke up, drifting away disinterestedly. A couple threw down parting rays as they left. The sobbing stopped. Silence. Beside me, Wardani eeled her knees under her but could not get upright. No upper body strength in her recovering body. She looked wildly across at me. I propped myself up on my working arm, then levered myself to my feet.
"Stay there. I'll be back."
I went reflexively to check on the corpses, ducking stray nanocopters. The masks had frozen in rictus smiles, but faint ripples still ran through the plastic in intervals. As I watched the 2 the copters had killed, something frizzled under each head, and smoke spiraled up.
"Ah, shit!"
I ran back to the one I'd shot in the face, the one caught upright in the machine, but it was the same story. The base of the skull had already charred black and ragged, and the head was listing slightly against one of the climbing machine struts. Mist and the storm of fire from the nanocopters. Below the neat hole I'd put in the center of the mask, the mouth grinned at me with plastic insincerity.
"Fuck!"
"Kovach?"
"Yeah, sorry."
I stowed the smart gun and pulled Wardani unceremoniously to her feet. At the end of the room, the elevator opened and spilled out a squad of armed security. I sighed. "Here we go." They spotted us. The squad captain cleared her blaster.
"Remain still! Raise your hands!"
I lifted my working arm. Wardani shrugged.
"I'm not pissing about here, folks."
"We're injured," I called back. "Contact stunners. And everyone else is dead. Extremely. The bad guys had stacked blowout fail-safes. It's all over. Go wake Hand up."
Hand took it quite well, considering. He got them to turn over one of the corpses and crouched beside it, poking at the charred spinal cord with a metal stylus. "Molecular acid canister," he said thoughtfully. "Last year's Shawn Biotech. I didn't realize the Chempists had these yet." "They've got everything you've got, Hand. They've just got a lot less of it, that's all. Read your Brankovich. Trickle-down and war-based markets."
"Yes, thank you, Kovac." Hand rubbed at his eyes. "I already have a doctorate in conflict investment. I don't really need the gifted amateur reading list. What I would like to know, however, is what you two are doing down here at this time of the morning." I exchanged a look with Wardani. She shrugged.
"We were fucking,"
she said. Han blinked. "Oh," he said. "Already?"
"What's that supposed to..."
"Kovac, please. You're giving me a headache."
He got up and nodded at the head of the forensic squad, who was hovering nearby.
"Okay, get them out of here. See if you can get a tissue match for those scrapes we took out of Find Alley and the canal head. File C221MH. Central clearing will let you have the codes."
We all watched as the dead were loaded onto ground effect gurneys and escorted to the elevators. Han just caught himself returning the stylus to his jacket and handed it to the last of the retreating forensic squad. He brushed the ends of his fingers absently against each other.
"Someone wants you back, Mr. Swardani," he said. "Someone with resources. I suppose that in itself ought to reassure me as to the value of our investment in you."
Wardani made a faint, ironic bow. "Someone with wires to the inside, too," I added somberly. "Even with a backpack full of intrusion gear, there's no way they got in here without help. You've got leakage."
"Yes, so it would appear."
"Who did you send to check out those shadows we brought back from the bar the night before last?"
Wardani looked at me, alarmed.
"Someone followed us?"
I gestured at Hand. "So he says."
"Hand?"
"Yes, Mr. Swardani, that is correct. You were followed as far as Find Alley."
He sounded very tired, and the glance he shot at me was defensive.
"It was Deng, I think."
"Deng? Are you serious? Shit, how long do you guys give line-of-duty casualties before you jam them back into a sleeve?"
"Deng had a clone on ice," he snapped back. "That's standard policy for security operations managers. And he got a virtual week of counseling and full-impact recreational leave before he was downloaded. He was fit for duty."
"Was he? Why don't you call him?"
I was remembering what I'd said to him in the IDNA construct. The men and women you work for would sell their own children into a brothel if it meant getting their hands on what I showed them tonight. And alongside of that, my friend, you don't matter. Just killed is a fragile state of mind for the uninitiated. It makes you susceptible to suggestion, and envoys are past masters at persuasion. Hand had his audiophone open.
"Wake up Deng Xiaojun, please."
He waited.
"I see. Well, try that then."
I shook my head. "That good old spit in the sea that nearly drowned you bravado, huh, Han? Barely over the death trauma, and you're throwing him back into action on a related case? Come on, put the phone away. He's gone. He sold you out and skipped with a loose change."
Han's jaw nodded, but he kept the phone at his ear.
"Hand, I practically told him to do it." I met the sideways flung disbelief in his eyes. "Yeah, go ahead. Blame me if it makes you feel better. I told him Mandrake didn't give a shit about him, and you went ahead and proved it by cutting a deal with us. And then you put him on watchdog detail just to rub it in."
"I did not assign Deng. God damn you, Kovac."
He was hanging onto his temper by shreds, biting down on it. His hand was white-knuckled on the phone.
"And you had no business telling him anything. Now shut the fuck up." "Yes, yes, this is Hand."
He listened, spoke controlled monosyllables, acid-etched with frustration, snapped the phone closed.
"Deng left the tower in his own transport early last night. He disappeared in the old clearinghouse mall a little before midnight."
"Just can't get the staff these days, huh?"
"Kovac."
The exec snapped out his hand, as if physically holding me at arm's length. His eyes were hard with mastered anger,
I don't want to hear it, all right? I don't want to hear it.
I shrugged. No one ever does. That's why this sort of thing keeps on happening. Hand breathed out, compressed.
I am not going to debate employment law with you, Kovach, at 5 a.m.
He turned on his heel.
You two had better get your act together. We download into the Dangra construct at 9.
I looked sideways at Wardani and caught a smirk. It was childishly contagious, and it felt like hands linking behind the Mandrake exec's back. 10 paces off, hands stopped, as if he'd sensed it.
Oh, he turned to face us. By the way, the Kempists airburst a Marauder bomb over Sobaville an hour ago. High yield, 100% casualties.
I caught the flare of white in Wardani's eye as she snatched her gaze away from mine. She stared at the lower middle distance, mouth clamped. Han stood there and watched it happen.
Thought you'd both like to know that, he said.
Chapter 17. Dangrek. The sky looked like old denim, faded blue bowl ripped with threads of white cloud at high altitude. Sunlight filtered through, bright enough to make me narrow my eyes. Warm fingers of it brushed over exposed portions of my skin. The wind had risen a little since last time, buffeting from the west. Little black drifts of fallout dusted off the vegetation around us. At the headland, Sobaville was still burning. The smoke crawled up into the old denim sky like the wipings of heavily oiled fingers.
Proud of yourself, Kovach?
Tanya Wardani muttered it in my ear as she walked past me to get a better look from farther up the slope. It was the first thing she'd said to me since Hand broke the news. I went after her. You got a complaint about this, you'd better go register it with Joshua Kemp, I told her when I caught up. And anyway, don't act like this is new. You knew it was coming like everybody else.
Yes. I'm just a little gorged on it right now.
It was impossible to get away from. Screens throughout the Mandrake Tower had run it nonstop. Bright pinhead to bladder flash in silence, reeled in on some military documentary team's cameras, and then the sound. Gabbled commentary over a rolling thunder and the spreading mushroom cloud. Then the lovingly freeze-frame advanced replays. The MAI had gobbled it up and incorporated it for us. Wiped that irritating gray fuzz indeterminacy from the construct.
Suchiari, get your team deployed.
It was Han's voice, drumming through the induction rig speaker. A loose exchange of military shorthand followed, and in irritation I yanked the speaker away from its resting place behind my ear. I ignored the footfalls of someone tramping up the slope behind us, and focused on the locked posture of Tanya Wardani's head and neck.
I guess it was quick for them then,
she said, still staring out at the headland. Like the song says, nothing faster.
Mistress Wardani.
It was Ole Hansen. Some echo of the arc light intensity from his original blue eyes somehow burning through the wide-set dark gaze of his new sleeve.
We'll need to see the demolition site.
She choked back something that might have been a laugh, and didn't say the obvious thing.
Sure,
she said instead.
Follow me.
I watched the two of them pick their way down the other side of the slope toward the beach.
Hoi, envoy guy!
I turned unwillingly and spotted Yvette Cruikshank navigating her Maori sleeve uncertainly up the slope toward me. Sunjet slung flat across her chest and a set of ranging lenses pushed up on her head. I waited for her to reach me, which she did without tripping in the long grass more than a couple of times.
How's the new sleeve?
I called as she stumbled for the second time.
Yep.
She shook her head, closed the gap, and started again, voice lowered back to normal.
Subfraction strange, know what I mean?
I nodded. My first resleeve was more than 30 subjective years in my past, objectively close to 2 centuries ago. But you don't forget. The initial re-entry shock never really goes away.
Bit fucking pallid, too.
She pinched up the skin on the back of her hand and sniffed.
How come I couldn't get some fine black cover like yours?
I didn't get killed, I reminded her. Besides, once the radiation starts to bite, you're going to be glad. What you're wearing there needs about half the dosage I'll be taking to stay operational. She scowled. Still going to get us all in the end, though, isn't it? It's only a sleeve, Crookshank.
That's right. Just give me some of that envoy cool.
She barked a laugh and upended her sunjet, gripping the short, thick barrel disconcertingly in one slim hand. Squinting up from the discharge channel and directly at me, she asked,
"Think you could go for a white girl's sleeve like this, then?"
I considered. The Maori combat sleeves were long on limb and broad in the chest and shoulders. A lot of them, like this one, were pale-skinned, and being fresh out of the clone tanks accentuated the effect. But faces ran to high cheekbones, wide-spaced eyes, and flaring lips and noses. White girl's sleeve seemed a little harsh. And even inside the shapeless battlefield camelio-chrome coveralls,
"You're gonna look like that," Crookshank remarked. "You'd better be buying something."
Sorry, just giving the question my full consideration.
"Yeah, I'll skip it. I wasn't that worried. You were operational around here, weren't you?"
"A couple of months back."
"So what was it like?"
I shrugged. "People shooting at you? Air full of pieces of fast-moving metal looking for a home? Pretty standard stuff. Why?"
"I heard the wedge got a pasting."
"That true?" "It certainly looked that way from where I was standing."
"So how come Kemp suddenly decides from a position of strength to cut and nuke?"
"Crookshank," I started, and then stopped, unable to think of a way to get through the armor plate of youth she was wearing. She was 22, and like all 22-year-olds, she thought she was the immortal focal point of this universe. Sure, she'd been killed, but so far all that had done was prove the immortal part. It would not have occurred to her that there might be a worldview in which what she saw was not only marginal, but almost wholly irrelevant. She was waiting for an answer. "Look," I said finally, "no one told me what we were fighting for up here, and from what we got out of the prisoners we interrogated, I'd say they didn't know either. I gave up expecting this war to make sense a while ago, and I'd advise you to do the same if you plan on surviving much more of it." She raised an eyebrow, a mannerism that she hadn't quite nailed in her new sleeve.
"So you don't know, then?"
"No."
"Crookshank!"
Even with my own induction rig unhooked, I heard the tinny crash of Marcus Cicciotti's voice over the comlink.
"You want to get down here and work for a living like the rest of us?"
"Coming, Cap."
She pulled a mouth-down face in my direction and started back down the slope. A couple of steps down, she stopped and turned back.
"Hey, envoy guy."
"Yeah?"
"That stuff about the wedge taking a pasting. Wasn't a crit, okay? Just what I heard."
I felt myself grinning at the carefully deployed sensitivity. "Forget it, Crookshank. Couldn't give a shit. I'm more bent out of shape. You didn't like me drooling on you."
"Oh,"
she grinned back.
"Well, I guess I did ask."
Her gaze dropped to my crotch, and she crossed her eyes for effect.
"What about I get back to you on that one?"
"Do that." The induction rig buzzed against my neck. I stuck it back in place and hooked up the mic.
"Yeah, Cicciotti?" "If it's not too much trouble, sir."
The irony dripped off the last word.
"Would you mind leaving my soldiers alone while they deploy?"
"Yeah, sorry. Won't happen again."
"Good."
I was about to disconnect when Tanya Wardani's voice came across the net in soft expletives.
"Who's that?" snapped Cicciotti. "Son?"
"I don't fucking believe this."
"It's Mistress Wardani, sir."
Ole Hansen came in, laconically calm over the muttered curses from the archaeologue.
"I think you'd better all get down here and take a look at this."
I raced Hand to the beach and lost by a couple of meters. Cigarettes and damaged lungs don't count in a virtuality, so it must have been concern for Mandrake's investment that drove him. Very commendable. Still not attuned to their new sleeves, the rest of the party fell behind us. We reached Wardani alone. We found her in much the same position she'd taken up facing the rockfall last time we'd been in the construct. For a moment, I couldn't see what she was looking at. "Where's Hansen?" I asked stupidly.
"He went in,"
she said, waving a hand forward.
For what it's worth.
Then I saw it. The pale bite mark.